From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
He's got him! Jamie Moyer to the history books.
Jamie Moyer became the oldest pitcher in Major League history to win a ballgame in April of 2012 when he was 49. Today, he talks about how he learned to be a more effective pitcher in his 40s than he was in his 20s, and about how to shake up a big league hitter. And he'll describe the time he pitched wearing a garter belt a friend gave him for good luck.
So I thought, all right, I'll wear it. But I was really concerned because it was purple and black. I was really concerned that you're going to be able to see it through my white pants. To this day, still doesn't believe that I wore it.
Moyer has a new memoir called Just Tell Me I Can't. Also, Ken Tucker reviews the new pop rock album from Haim, a band of three Southern California sisters and musical virtuosos. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last year, our guest Jamie Moyer became the oldest pitcher ever to record a win in the majors. He was 49. But Moyer's story isn't just the tale of a talented guy who hung on to his game a little longer than others. He was actually a more effective pitcher in his 40s than in his 20s because he got control of the mental side of his game. And he did it with the help of a gruff, self-taught sports psychologist named Harvey Dorfman. Moyer was never blessed with a blazing fastball. His speed was below average, even in his youth. And to compete in the big leagues, he had to locate his pitches with pinpoint accuracy and outthink his hitters. He's managed to do that plenty, and with an extraordinary work ethic, keep his body in shape to play with men half his age. In fact, when he beat out an infield hit last year, he also became the oldest big leaguer to ever get a run batted in. Moyer pitched for 8 teams, but his best years were with the Seattle Mariners, where he became an all-star, and the Philadelphia Phillies, where he was a starter in a season they won the World Series. His new memoir with writer Larry Platt, called Just Tell Me I Can't, is full of inside baseball tales, like how he got inside hitters' heads, worked umpires to get a better strike zone, and learned to use his teeth, yes, his teeth, to tell his catcher he was changing the location of the pitch he was throwing. Moyer spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Jamie Moyer, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Dave.
You know, you look at a baseball diamond in a stadium, and the field and the mound are the same dimensions that you pitched on in high school. But ballparks differ in some ways. Are there somewhere the mound felt different?
Yeah. Yeah, there are dimensions, and height restrictions that we're able to use. But it gets policed quite stringently by the league, but if you will call the tabletop, the very top of the mound, some of those are built differently. I can tell you the one in Oakland seems like you're on a huge, huge stage, whereas some of the other ballparks don't seem as big. And I think sometimes the background that where I'd be facing behind home plate, some are a lot closer, some are brick, some have signage on them, but the ones that are further back make the plate feel like it's further away from home plate. So it's a visual, mm-hmm. but it's also creates a feeling for you as well.
Did you have tricks to making yourself feel comfortable in a place that you didn't particularly like? You didn't like Pittsburgh's mound, I read.
I didn't. I wasn't real fond of Pittsburgh's mound. And the only reason I wasn't fond of it, I didn't like the clay that they used. It was very difficult to work with. It was usually very hard. It seemed to dry out as the game went on. And I could usually tell after game because my calluses would have blisters, if you can believe that or not. But my feet would be really sore after I pitched there.
You had Pittsburgh feet that day, huh?
Yes, I did.
You know, Oral Hershiser once said in a postgame interview, I remember this, he said that pitching in the big leagues is like climbing a mountain when you start a game. What did your body feel like the day after you pitched 5 or 6 or more innings?
That's a great question. And, it depends. I think it depends on the duress that you went through during the course of a game. If it was an easy game and they're never easy, but if you didn't have a lot of guys on base and you weren't pitching out of jams constantly and you got a lot of, one, two, three pitch outs during the course of the game, and, like you say, you weren't under stress you had to make quality pitches all the time to get out of a jam and to get out of an inning after inning after inning. Those days, you kind of felt the next day like, I knew that I worked the day before, but I didn't feel like I was beaten up. Whereas the games where you were in trouble, say some games I was in trouble from the first pitch. There were a number of games where I let, the game started off with the guy hitting the first pitch of the game as a home run. So now I'm losing 1-0 and I've thrown one pitch. Or the first pitch of the game, a guy hits a double, and then the next guy hits a single, and then maybe I walk a guy, and then maybe there's an error. Now all of a sudden you're creating a lot of distress, and now you're fighting your way through that, and you constantly have to make a good pitch. And early in the game, you're trying to establish, what you want to do. You're trying to create a tempo. You want to take control of that game, and the offense is not allowing that to happen. So those types of days, the next day after, you're usually a lot more sore, and mentally you're exhausted.
Hmm. Harvey Dorfman is an important figure in your life and in your story, kind of an early sports psychologist. Tell us what was happening in your career when you first went to see him.
I was really, I don't want to say I was quite at crossroads, but I had really an up and down career. If you're looking at numbers, I had a career losing record. As a pitcher, I was very inconsistent. I was in my late 20s trying to find myself as a, you know, in the major leagues, which was kind of scary if when I look back at it. Harvey was really into sports, but was born with an asthmatic disorder and really wasn't able to be an athlete per se as a child and through his youthful years, but really kind of followed sports and had a passion for sports. He ended up, you know, getting a degree, an English degree, was an English teacher, coached a women's basketball team, and somehow got a job with the Oakland A's, Harvey Dorfman and Carl Kuehl. And, you know, he did a lot of this sports psychology stuff with the A's, and he wrote a book, The Mental Game of Baseball, with Carl Kuehl. And like I said, I read that book, thought I understood it, and then spending time with Harvey, really realized that I didn't understand it. And he really taught me to think about what I was doing, analyze what I was doing, and not, you know, in the book, he talks about paralysis by analysis. And I think sometimes we can get too much information and paralyze ourselves with all of the information and forget the task at hand. And he was really big on trying to teach, focusing, you know, what is the task that I'm trying to conquer? And for me, that was, you know, the mental side of the game. That's my preparation, my focus, my accountability, who I was as a person, you know, staying in your own person, not trying to be somebody else. And all these things I was trying to do as a competitive Major League Baseball pitcher, and I was really so concerned about results that I was losing focus on really who I was and what got me to the Major League level.
Now, Harvey, he didn't rub your shoulders and say it's going to be okay. He was a tough
no,
guy.
he was a harsher, on a little bit on the harsher side, brash. His language was, you know, I didn't mind it, though. I enjoyed it because, you know, he was challenging. He was always trying to challenge you,
right.
And I really enjoyed that aspect of it.
One of the things that it seems you had to address was pitching afraid. You're pitching and you're looking into the dugout to see if the manager's picking up the phone to get somebody working in the bullpen. You're wondering what's going to happen if I don't make this pitch. And he wanted you to be aggressive. Talk about your fear of pitching inside, that is to say throwing pitches close to the batter.
Right. And that's a great point. It really wasn't being afraid of throwing pitches necessarily close to the batter. But if I throw it inside and I miss, and I don't miss on the inner part of the plate towards the hitter, I miss over the middle of the plate. Oh, my gosh, the results are going to be a home run, or they're going to hit it hard. They're going to hit it, and I'm going to have bad results. Well, what I was focusing on was the result, instead of focusing on the task. So the task for me, what he taught me, was to let's focus on good mechanics, which are going to allow me to make that appropriate pitch and hit the location that I want to hopefully give the hitter the wrong results that he wants and make him become the frustrated person and not myself.
You were never a guy who threw 90 miles an hour.
No.
So you relied upon finesse, pinpoint location, picking the right pitches. And one of the things that it seems Harvey got you to see is the need to be aggressive, to use your off-speed pitch, to use that slow stuff aggressively on hitters. Explain what that means. How does that
work? Well, he got me to realize what my abilities were. And again, you're right. My fastball was below average, but my changeup was really my, if you will, my money pitch or my out pitch.
And for folks who don't watch baseball a lot, a changeup is the pitch that you throw that looks like a fastball coming at the batter, but because of the grip, it comes more slowly and they swing too quickly, miss it.
Right. They react to a fastball because that's what their eyes are telling them. And that's where I had a lot of my success in the minor leagues and not as much success in the major leagues because, again, I didn't have the confidence in my own abilities. So what he was trying to teach me was to say, look, here's your fastball. Learn how to locate it, which that's what I was in that process of doing. You know, good mechanics is going to allow good location, but, you know, my focus on that had to be that. But using that as a tool, and or as, if you will, a weapon, even though I wasn't using it at the hitter, I was using it against the hitter. And then that my changeup that I threw, again, being aggressive with it, not passive with it, you know, now using that against them and knowing that we all have an ego. And in baseball, those egos sometimes can be really big. And hitters can have really big egos. And, you know, not only do they want to hit home runs, they want to hit them 30 rows back because that's what people want to see. So now take that ego that they have and use it against them. So now if I can throw a hard pitch, maybe it's just off the plate, but now I throw the same pitch or a pitch looking just like it, but it's 8 to 10 miles an hour, 12 miles an hour slower, and they swing like it's the hard pitch. Now all of a sudden they're thinking it's a fastball and they're swinging way ahead of the ball. And now they become frustrated. And that's where the game of, if you will, the game of chess or the game of cat and mouse in baseball really comes into play.
Do you think hitters sense doubt in a pitcher?
Oh, yeah. Body language or your posture on the mound, the way you act and react in situations, hitters feed off of that. And you could tell on days when guys have are showing bad body language on the mound, it would almost be like the hitters were running up to home plate to hit. But you could also flip that too. As a pitcher, when things were going really well, you could read hitters. If, say, you threw a pitch and a guy took the pitch and it was a called strike and you got a reaction like, you know, his shoulders went down or he complained to the umpire, all of a sudden now, you know, it was like, hey, that wasn't a strike. Now they've become distracted with what was going on. So now, you know, for me to be able to read that, and now I'm ahead in the count, maybe now the next pitch doesn't have to be a strike, but if I can make it look like a strike as it's approaching the plate, but when it gets to the plate, it's not a strike, and I get them to offer at it, again, they're swinging at something that they didn't really want to swing at or they weren't comfortable swinging at.
And that's being aggressive. You're taking the hitter out of his focus and reacting to what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you say that a pitcher can have bad posture, which will indicate that he's frustrated. What's the posture you want to never show on the mound? And then what's the posture you do want to show?
The posture that you never want to show, for me, is to throw a pitch and, you know, you kind of get, your body gets a little droopy, you're whining, your body kind of crumbles. And, you know, you catch the ball and you snap at the ball. You know, you're glaring at the umpire. You're whining to the umpire. And that's very visible from, you know, 60 feet away. The hitter sees that. Your teammates see that. The fans see that. The broadcasters see that. You know, everybody sees that. But to me, you want to show absolutely nothing. You want to have strong eyes. You want to be staring at your target. And you're really showing no emotion. And you want to show that, you know, I'm in control here. You want to get the ball back. You want to create a good tempo between pitches. You don't want to lollygag around and kick the dirt and mosey around like, you know, this is a drudgery. You want to get the ball. You want to get back up on the mound, take your sign, and make your next pitch.
You know, you pitched later in your career here in Philadelphia, so a lot of us saw a lot of Jamie Moyer. And I remember your expression on the mound. You could never tell what you were thinking.
And that's ideal. And, you know, those who watch the Phillies play, you watch Chase Utley hit. He shows no emotion at home plate. And that's exactly, as a pitcher, that's exactly what I'm trying to do as well. You don't want to give the hitter anything to feed off of.
We're speaking with Jamie Moyer. His new memoir is called Just Tell Me I Can't. And we'll talk some more after a quick break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, our guest is Jamie Moyer. He is the oldest pitcher ever to win a game in the big leagues, had a long career, and he's written a book about the mental side of pitching and his own career. It's called Just Tell Me I Can't. A lot of the book deals with the rigor with which you prepare for a game, with which you train and discipline yourself. And one of my favorite stories about your work ethic and preparation comes from 2012 when you're making a comeback and you're in the spring training camp for the Colorado Rockies.
Mm-hmm.
There's this assignment to introduce another team player. Tell us that story.
Yeah, well, it was interesting. The very first day, they had new complexes now, and the Rockies and the Diamondbacks share a beautiful, beautiful state-of-the-art complex. And inside of our part of the complex, they have like a video or a movie room. It's like a theater. It's it's tilted. There's theater seats in it, and you can put video up, you can speak, and all that kind of stuff. So part of what the Rockies were going to do that year is they wanted everybody to pick a name out of a hat and introduce that person.
A teammate.
Well, yes. The teammate that I picked was Jeremy Guthrie, who I didn't know very well. I was a new guy to that organization. Plus, he was a new guy to that new organization. And I volunteered to go first. So I thought, okay, I'm going to make mine stand out. I don't know Jeremy at all. And the person wasn't supposed to know that you picked him. So what I did is I talked to the PR people. I got a phone number to his wife, who then gave me a phone number to his mother, who then I kind of did a little bit of an interview about Jeremy's background and upbringing. Got a bunch of information from his mother, and then I talked to his wife, and then I just kind of wrote out what I wanted to write. And it was my day to go, and I got up, and I had about a page and a half to 2 pages of information about Jeremy. And as you gave your information, the rest of the group was to try to guess who that person was. So it was a way for people to get to know about their teammates.
Right, but a lot of the other players, they Googled the guy. They gave his stats.
Yeah.
You told them that he was a chess champion and was a bad little boy and drove his big wheels too fast.
Yeah.
And I guess the point
is, he actually ran away one day, and his mom had to call the police to find him.
But I guess the point is, if you're going to do a job, do it right.
Exactly. And go to some length and detail. And I thought, some of these things would be fun for his teammates to know. Actually, one of the things was in junior high, he was a businessman and he went out and bought candy bars and sold them in school out of his locker. And he got caught and he got in trouble doing for that, too. But he was showing his, entrepreneurial side.
Right. So we'll see if he doctors the baseball as he moves down the road. Now, one thing ballplayers do is to visit kids in hospitals and do other charitable and community work. There's a story in the book about your interaction with a 2-year-old child named Gregory Chaya. Do I have the name right?
Yes, you do.
Yeah. Tell us his story and what the relationship you developed with him and his parents.
Well, Gregory was a cancer patient, and he was at Johns Hopkins Children's Hospital in Baltimore. And the priest that married my wife and I asked us to go visit him. And we did. And at the time, we had a 1-year-old son. Who was healthy and vibrant. And I had made many visits to hospitals previous to this visit. And, they'd always be cordial, and you go in and you sign things and you chat with the patients and, you wish them well and you kind of walk out the door and, in a lot of cases you don't hear from them again. Well, in this particular case, when we went to visit Gregory, knowing that he was a very sick little boy, and us having a very healthy boy, I felt very privileged to have a healthy son. But on our visit, you could see his pain. You could see his family's pain. But the cool thing was you could feel it through his mother at the time of the visit, Marge, and through Gregory, that he was going to survive this very rare form of cancer that he had. It was leukemia, AML. And I felt very sorry for him. I mean, here's a little boy who was fighting for his life on a daily basis. And here was Jamie Moyer, the selfish baseball player that was so concerned about his baseball life and his baseball career that this just didn't make sense to me, how I could be so selfish in worrying about my career, and this little boy may not be living for more than another month or two. And for some crazy reason, Gregory and I created a bond. And to this day, I don't know how to explain that, but it was amazing the support he tried to give me. And not only tried, he did. As a 2-year-old little boy, gave me support. And I was trying to support him, or we were trying to support he and his family. That it just struck me that, you know what? There's more to baseball.
Right. Well, I mean, clearly you were moved by this, and your wife, Karen,
yes.
had a lot of contact with him after that and the family. Mm-hmm. But shortly after that first visit, you put his initials on your cleats and
yes,
wear on your cap.
Not only my cleats, my hat, on my glove, and actually would put them in the dirt on the back of the mound. It just, you know what? He was in my heart daily.
And then
constantly.
And then reporters noticed it and asked you about it.
Yeah. And, you know, at times it was very difficult. And even at times now, it's very difficult for me to talk about. I mean, here's a little boy, like I said, you know, struggling for his life. And, you know, it just really humbled me. And it really allowed me to put my baseball career and my life into perspective. And from there, you know, we would talk quite often. If I was on the road, we would talk on the phone. We would talk after games. He would watch the games on TV. I'd go back to the hospital. We would kind of play in the room with a Nerf ball. And, you know, he went into remission, which was just amazing.
Yeah, he overcame a very grim prognosis and made it through. And do you think it changed your ability, your performance as a ball player, that experience?
It did. It did. I had energy that I never knew that I had. I was at peace. Win or lose, I was at peace. Whereas before in my career, if I lost or didn't pitch well, it would eat at me and it would bother me. And, you know, it would affect me at home. It no longer affected me at home. I left my baseball at the ballpark, and my home life was my home life.
Jamie Moyer will continue his interview with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies in the second half of the show. Moyer's memoir is called Just Tell Me I Can't. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing reviews of local roofers, painters, landscapers, and plumbers to keep the consumer informed. More at angieslist.com. From Lumosity.com, with web-based brain games created by neuroscientists to improve memory and attention. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And from Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at Progressive.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, getting inside a hitter's head, how to work an umpire from the mound, wearing a garter belt for good luck, and getting teased for being the old man on the team. More with Jamie Moyer. Also, Ken Tucker reviews the debut album by the pop rock group Haim, which is open for Vampire Weekend and Mumford & Sons. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to the interview Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies recorded with Jamie Moyer. Last year, at the age of 49, Moyer became the oldest major league pitcher ever to win a game and the oldest to record an RBI. His new memoir, Just Tell Me I Can't, is full of inside baseball stories, including how he became a more effective pitcher in his 40s than he was in his 20s.
He played for Baltimore, and then you went to Boston, and then had great years in Seattle. I mean, great years for you as a pitcher, great years for the team and the city. Talk about the chemistry on that team.
Well, I really believe that the Seattle Mariners, at the you know, and not just because I was there, I was a part of it. I could witness it. But they had an uncanny knack of bringing quality people to the organization. And our manager at the time, Lou Piniella, did a great job in getting guys to believe in themselves and to play together as a team. And I think that was really, really important. And Lou was very passionate about winning. My most favorite manager that I've ever played for. But it was about, you felt like Lou was another teammate. And that's really what it was about, playing together. And again, the fan base really kind of wrapped their arms around us. Well, and it was very exciting times in Seattle.
Yeah, and folks who don't know Lou Piniella, I mean, should know that he threw a tantrum on the field better than anybody. I mean, ripping
yes,
his hat
he
off,
did.
Throwing bases more than once.
Right.
But
that was a way. That was also a way for him to motivate us as players. You know, by him going out and showing his anger, yeah, people looked at it as kind of a circus act. But, you know, there were, you know, many of those times when he did those tantrums or he took his hat off and threw it around and kicked it around, you know, and everybody laughed at it. But it was a way for him to let off some steam, but it motivated us players.
I want to talk some more about keeping the mental edge as a pitcher and how you practiced that over the years. One of the things that you've said is that hitters had big egos, and you would use their egos against them, try and get them frustrated, break their concentration. Would you say things to hitters often, like speak to them directly?
There were a couple times back when David Justice was with Cleveland, and I was pitching, and it was in the middle of the game. We were up a couple runs, and we were in a particular at-bat where it was just foul ball, foul ball, foul ball, foul ball. We got to like 9, 10, 11 pitches. And I walked towards home plate to get another ball from the umpire, and I stopped, and I said, David. And he kind of looked at me, because you usually don't talk, you know, from pitcher to hitter too often. And he kind of looked up at me, and I said, where do you want to pitch? And he kind of looked at me like, what did you just say to me? And he said, and he just kind of pointed, you know, out in front of him, like, right down the middle. And I said, okay.
And he wanted
and
a
I
fastball,
turned around.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, and he wanted a fastball. And now, you know, now for me, the cat and mouse game begins. All right, is he going to think I'm going to throw him a fastball? Is he going to take the pitch? Is he going to swing at it? Is it, you know, what's going to happen? So I could never tell him I'm going to throw something and throw something else because I had it already set in my mind. So I threw a fastball. He hit a home run. Well, he started laughing around the bases. And, you know, I couldn't fault the guy, you know. So he goes back in the dugout. He starts telling his teammates. They were all laughing, blah, 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 blah. And but he was, you know, the at-bat was over. And like I said, I was starting to get a little tired then. So I was like, all right, we're done. You know, you're out of here. It's a solo home run. No big deal. We end up winning the game. Next day, I see him. And he said, that's crazy. I can't believe you did that. And I said, well, you know, I kind of explained to him why I did it. And it's funny. I've seen him now a number of times in the last couple of years. And every time I see him, we laugh about it, but, you know, I've done it a couple times in my career.
Well, hang on. Explain to us why you did it. I mean, you're serving up
a
pitch.
Well, I did it because, again, I was trying to break up that tension that he and I had created, and I was trying to get him off of what, you know, he was kind of really focused on, you know, getting a hit. And like I said, I just kept throwing pitch after pitch after pitch. Everything I threw, he fouled off. So I was to the point where it was like, again, I'm not going to say I gave up, but I wanted to try to beat him on the mental part of it, hoping that he would do something he didn't want to do.
Lose his
but
focus.
He stayed, yeah. Right, yeah. But he stayed on course, and he beat me at my own little game. So, again, I tried to pick and choose when I would do that, but I did it a couple other times in my career. And, you know, I didn't do it real often, but it was just one of those times where that tension was building and building and building.
Now you're a pitcher that relies on accuracy and on finesse and on mixing mm-hmm. up pitches rather than mm-hmm. speed. You don't overpower
changing
hitters.
Timing. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to affect timing because that's all hitting is timing.
Right. So the 79 mile an hour pitch followed by a 62 mile an hour pitch can be
right.
tricky. Right.
Right.
Or vice versa.
Right. Right. Especially if I can make them look the same out of my hand.
Right. But location is critical, which means that if you have an umpire that is, as they say, pinching the strike zone, calling a narrower strike zone, that's going to be I can remember a few starts when when that happened to you.
I had a game in the playoffs against Milwaukee.
Right.
That you
Paul
know,
Runge
really
was the umpire. We all remember that one. And what I wanted to ask is, you know, it's illegal in the game. You can argue a lot of things in the game. You're not allowed to argue balls and strikes. You can be ejected for it.
In today's game, that's the way it is.
But is there a way you can work an umpire from the mound?
You can. You know, you can respectfully, you know, give them a little bit of a glare or, you know, there have been times where I didn't like the way the game was going as far as balls and strikes, and I'd call my catcher out to the mound. And for no particular reason did I want to talk to my catcher. But if you stand out there long enough with the catcher, the umpire will come walking out. And usually I was having a conversation with the catcher when the umpire would walk out, and he'd come out and say, hey, let's go, you know, let's speed it up here. And I'd wait till the umpire got all the way to the mound, and I would continue to talk to the catcher, but I was really talking to the umpire.
It's saying what?
And I'd be asking him about, you know, hey, where was that last pitch? Or is my catcher blocking your pitches? Or, you know, are you having a tough day? Because there are a lot of times where I'd walk off the field and say, hey, bear with me, I'm having a tough day. You know, when I wasn't throwing strikes or consistent strikes. So what I was really just trying to do was get the umpire to think about what he was calling and trying to do it in a respectful way. I don't want to be demonstrative because I do respect that this is his job too. And I don't want to I'm not trying to create any animosity between myself and the umpire because the umpire can really be beneficial to me.
Right. So anybody on the stands or watching on television who looks at that encounter sees you talking to your catcher.
Right.
And so you're not embarrassing the umpire. You're not showing him up. You're not yelling at him.
Right.
But he is hearing you make your case. Did you find it worked?
At times it did. Here's another one. Maybe we were in a key point of the game, and my catcher would legitimately come out and say, hey, what do you want to do here? And I'd be like, I'd be in between thoughts. I'd be thinking about, well, maybe this pitch or maybe that pitch. That's what I was thinking about. And I'd say to the catcher, well, what do you think? And he'd say, well, maybe a change up here. Well, at that point, the umpire would be walking out to the mound. And he'd say, okay, boys, let's go. You know, let's get back at this. And I'd make sure he was close enough. And I'd say, okay, let's go with the change up. And I'd say it loud enough that the umpire could hear it. Now, he would have time to think about it. And he'd be prepared for me throwing that changeup, and he usually knew where I was going to be throwing it. Now, he was prepared and looking in the area that I was throwing that pitch. You know, maybe I get the benefit of the doubt and get the call because we're in a tight situation.
There are a lot of great baseball stories in this book, and one of them that I loved that was new to me was you using your teeth to signal a change in the pitch the catcher wanted you to throw.
Yeah, a change in a location.
Yeah, explain this.
Yep. And for most pitches, you don't change location. I would change location with my changeup, and I would change location with my fastball, and I would change location with the cutter. It's almost like a slider.
And when we say change, the catcher gives you a signal for the pitch?
So he gives me say we're going to throw a fastball, and he calls for a fastball in, and I say yes. And then I change my mind and want to throw it away. Well, if I say yes,
meaning you nod your head, right?
If I say yeah, if I nod my head yes and then shake my head no, well, most hitters know that, you know, most pitches you're going to change location with is going to be a fastball. So they're going to sit on a fastball. And I learned this real quick. Here's a little side story off of that. I played with a wily catcher, Jim Sundberg, who was a teammate, but faced him in spring training in an inter-squad game. And I did that. I went yes, and I went no. And I changed the location with my fastball, and he hit a home run. And afterwards, I said, how did you know that? And he said, well, of course, you know, you're crazy. You should know that. And I didn't at that time. I was a very young player.
So the point was you tipped him by nodding your head yes and then shaking your head no. So he knows, he's changing the location. It's got to be a fastball. Here I go.
Right. Yep. So it was a learning lesson as a young player in spring training. So now what I would do in a game, if I wanted to change that location, now we're back to that fastball in, the catcher would move in. And as I started my motion, I would show my catcher my teeth. Okay, like smile, and that would change the location. So we would go from a fastball in to a fastball away.
Wow, did you do that a lot?
He would pick up on that. I did it a fair amount. It depended on my catcher. If I felt like my catcher had been really observant to what was going on, or I had just had conversation or reminded him about it, I would do it a fair amount. I wouldn't do it a whole lot. I learned that trick from Nolan Ryan.
And then you just better hope your catcher doesn't go to another team and tell all the hitters when Moyer shows his teeth, he's
changing
his
location.
Yeah, but
you know what? I have to do that and then throw a curveball. Because right. I would, you know, if I did it on a curveball, I would tell my catcher it means absolutely nothing.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So every now and then I'd throw a curveball and I'd show him my teeth. So if I ever had that doubt that the other team had it, now I'd show him my teeth.
We're speaking with Jamie Moyer. His memoir of his life in baseball is called Just Tell Me I Can't. And we'll continue our conversation after a short break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and we're speaking with former Major League pitcher Jamie Moyer. His memoir of his years in the big leagues is called Just Tell Me I Can't. You know, as your career stretched on, I mean, you were pitching in your 40s, pitching effectively in your 40s, but it became a story. I mean, you know, the old guy, the ancient mariner. And, it, you know, I mean, here you are. I mean, you're an elite athlete, and guys in bar leagues or just in bars are calling you, you know, this old guy. How'd you feel about that?
You know, at first it bothered me a little bit, but after a while I realized that, you know, some people just don't know how to react to things or you know, speak to people in ways. And I learned to respect it, and I actually learned to enjoy it and have fun with it. I know when I played in Philadelphia, my teammates would always be razzing me about something about age. And, you know, it would always be funny. I could always look around and give them a little snarl and say, you know, respect your elders. But we had a lot of fun with it. And, you know, in baseball terms, I really was old. But in everyday life, I really wasn't. But I really found that, you know, playing into my 40s uplifted a lot of people. You don't know how many times I would walk on the streets and people would say, you know what, keep doing what you're doing. You know, I used to work out and now I started watching you pitch and now I'm back into working out or I'm into walking again or I'm into, you know, physical activity again. And, you know, that made me feel good. I never really looked at it that way. I never did it for those reasons. But it really started to allow me to feel good about, you know, who I was and what I was doing. And if I could help somebody that way, I think that was awesome.
You have a shaving kit you carry with some, what, memorabilia and kind of reminders.
I'm going to get to the serious stuff first. You know, through this work with Harvey, I carried a concentration grid that I made. And, you know, the concentration grid was numbers in little boxes and from 00 to 99, and they were, you know, spread out all over. And I visually had to go from 00 to 99, and I would time myself. And I couldn't use my fingers. There were some things, words that I had written on cards that I would read. I read them for 19 years, the same cards and the same concentration grid. And it really allowed me to refine my focus before I went out to pitch. But the fun thing that I had in my shaving kit was back when I was in Baltimore, if you remember the movie Bull Durham. And sure. There was a scene in the movie when somebody gave one of the players a garter belt for good luck. And I had a buddy who sent me one of those when I was struggling, when I was with the Baltimore Orioles for good luck. And you know, it was just one of those things that, you know, he said, all right, you know, I want you to wear this and, you know, it'll bring you good luck. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, what am I going to do with this? You know? And so I thought, all right, I'll wear it. And I'm thinking, well, how am I going to get this on? And, you know, I didn't want to, you know, we get dressed in the clubhouse with a bunch of guys. I'm thinking, I'm not going to pull a garter out and put it on. So I would get myself dressed and I'd put it in my back pocket and go in the bathroom. In the bathroom stall and pull my pants down, put the garter on, and then pull my pants back up, and I'd go pitch with it. But I was really concerned because it was purple and black. I was really concerned that you're going to be able to see it through my white pants. So I had, you know, those long things that kind of hang down the side. Kind of had to pull those up and tuck them in the waist, and, you know, and off I went. But actually, the first night that I wore it, I won a game against the Red Sox. And I started to wear it religiously after or when I pitched. And my buddy that I grew up with, Scooter Myers, at home. To this day, still doesn't believe that I wore it, but I did.
Well, you know, it brings up the subject of superstition, you know, and I remember a scene in Bull Durham where Crash Davis is talking to Annie, folks who mm-hmm. know them, and the pitcher, Nuke LaLoosh, who's
right.
all over the place, is not having sex and is on a winning streak. And and there's a whole reason that Annie's angry about that. But Crash Davis, the veteran catcher, says you respect a streak. And if a guy is winning, thinks he's winning because he's having sex or because he isn't having sex, then he is. And this raises the question, since a lot of what you've done is this really kind of rational focus, I mean, kind of bringing the powers of focus to the game, mm-hmm. which is sort of at odds with, you know, some of the superstitions, you know, that
right.
that ball players care. Are you at all a superstitious guy? Does Harvey respect superstition?
No, he would not respect that at all. He thinks that's a bunch of hogwash. And hence, I never told him that I wore that garter belt either. But yeah, I call it stupidstitious. And, you know, guys do their things. And, you know, Wade Boggs used to eat chicken before he played. And, you know, it worked for him. And I think, you know, for some people, you know, if they feel like that helps, then, you know, let it be. But I don't know that it really helps. You know, it's a long season and it can get kind of monotonous. So, you know, you kind of have fun with things and it just kind of breaks things up at times. But no, I'm a believer that, you know, if you can focus and you have that will of concentration, your ability will take over.
After a game, could you remember every pitch?
There are some games, yeah, I could go back for a couple of days and pretty much tell you every pitch I threw. And then there are other games when, you know, maybe my focus and concentration wasn't there. And you could take me off the field and talk about a pitch two innings previous, and I wouldn't remember it.
Now that you're out of the game, do you ever dream about playing, about pitching?
I have dreams about when I have pitched. They're pleasant dreams. They're pleasant dreams about playing. A dream that I had while I was playing, a lot of times I'd wake up in the middle of the night, and I think it was, you know, one of those subconscious dreams where you didn't really remember or you didn't know what was going on in the dream, but I'd wake up with a line drive coming right at me, and I'd be sweating.
Oh.
It's not a good feeling to have.
Did you ever get hit?
I have gotten hit, nothing serious, but I have gotten hit, and I've seen guys get hit and hurt seriously, and it's not fun.
No. I have to ask you this before we leave. I mean, you pitched in the big leagues last year. I mean, mm-hmm. after recovering from surgery, Tommy John mm-hmm. surgery, is it over?
It is. It is. I'm done. I don't think I'll be playing again. I do miss it, but I also respect that, you know, it's time for me to leave the game, and you know, my talent level has probably dropped off a little bit. And, you know, I enjoyed my career. I would not look back and say I would change one thing. And I can walk away from the game smiling and feel like I did it the way I was supposed to do, and that was hard work. And that's how I was raised. I was raised with parents from southeastern Pennsylvania, blue-collar family. And work and dedication is what it was all about.
A lot of people think you'd be a natural pitching coach or big league manager. Is that an aspiration?
It's something that, you know, I would always consider. Right now, we have a foundation, like I said, the Moyer Foundation, and I'm actually going to try to open up a pitching academy called the Moyer Pitching Academy and try to share the experiences that I've had over the course of my career and share the knowledge that I've been able to gain from others and the experiences that I've been through. And I feel it's a great way for myself to be able to give back to the game of baseball.
Well, Jamie Moyer, it's been fun. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Dave, thank you for your time.
Jamie Moyer spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Moyer's new memoir is called Just Tell Me I Can't. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the debut album by the pop group Haim, which has opened for Vampire Weekend and Mumford & Sons. This is Fresh Air.
We'll be right back.
This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of the debut album by Haim, a pop group led by sisters Estelle, Danielle, and Alana Haim. The Southern California trio has opened for acts such as Mumford & Sons and Vampire Weekend. Before the release this week of their album Days Are Gone, the group attracted attention for their new take on pop rock.
The three Haim sisters are in their 20s with plenty of experience, including some earlier years spent playing in a band formed by and performing with their parents. Each is a multi-instrumentalist, each sings. They write their own material. Here ends the questions of authenticity part of the review. Not that questions of being musical lightweights are going to be resolved for some listeners, because Haim works in that most vexed and scorned of genres, pop rock.
You know I'm bad. It's the hardest thing for me to do, and it's it. It's the most important part that relationships will go through. And I give it all away just so I could say that. But I know that you're gonna be okay anyway. You know there's no rhyme or reason for the way you turned out to be. I didn't go and try to change my mind not intentionally. I know it's hard to hear me say it, but I can't bear to stay. I just know that you're gonna be okay anyway.
Your notion of pop rock may derive from American manufactured products like the Monkees and the Archies, or from British acts like T-Rex and the Sweet, from whom Haim probably extracted the thumping beat of that song, The Wire. I'd suggest that these Southern California sisters are tapping into that geographical area for precedence. Anything from the 60s harmonies of the Mamas and the Papas to the 80s pop punk of the Bangles. On a song such as Honey and I, you can also hear the vocal inflections of a Canada-imported Lady of the Canyon, Joni Mitchell. The Haim sound is one of vocals, guitars, and drums hovering over thick layers of synthesizers and keyboards. To make this sound work, it has to be structured around a crisp verse-chorus-verse structure, or it just sounds like dreamy or irritating noodling around. The lyrics focus on falling in love and coming to terms with one's own power in a relationship. They tend to be less important, however, than the sound of the singing. In this, the sisters benefit a bit from harmonies bred in the genes. But in every case, one of them seizes the lead with that nice pop rock paradox, plaintive assertiveness. Occasionally, they remind you they're part of the hip-hop generation by mixing things up in a precisely fractured composition such as My Song 5.
I found it hard, tried to reserve. I'll get it right when I am
honey, honey, I am never coming home again. I've been like
Ultimately, a big part of the proof of Haim's worth is whether this already highly publicized act can turn its hype into hits. The fate and glory of pop rock is that it needs to actually be popular to complete the circuit of success. Without it, you're a cult act that's lucky to attract a cult. If I was younger and Haim had a fan club, I'd probably join it. But the real bottom line question is, how many of you out there would?
Rock critic Ken Tucker reviewed Days Are Gone by the sister group Haim. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. You can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. Our blog is on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Charlie Kyer. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our assistant producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Hey, you, remember me? Remember love? Remember trying to stay together my time? You took it all. You tried to see. You tried to bring yourself up without involving me. It isn't fair to have you away. To try to get up a goal. Na 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 na. Can't you see? It isn't fair to have you away. But I'm trying to get your attention. I need you to know.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Chevrolet, maker of the Volt, with electric technology to get there and fuel to go farther. Details at ChevyVolt.com. From Squarespace, providing domains, websites, and 24/7 support to creative professionals and small businesses. Learn more at squarespace.com. And from Novo Nordisk, committed to diabetes care and changing lives for more than 90 years. NovoNordisk-US.com. This is NPR.
As Saul said to Walt, it's over. It's over for Walt. Breaking Bad has ended, but it's not over yet for fans. There's still plenty to talk about. And on the next Fresh Air, we talk with two of Breaking Bad's writer-producers, Thomas Schnauz and Peter Gould. Join us.